If you happen to see a gray-haired woman with red glasses rocking out at your next Alice Cooper concert, chances are you've just caught a glimpse of Jane Scott. At 83, she's usually the oldest fan in the audience. But that hasn't slowed her down. Scott retired in May of 2002, ending a 50-year career as the rock critic for Cleveland's Plain Dealer. Even so, Scott says her concert-going days are far from over. Steve Paulson talked to Scott about her legendary career and the one that got away.
My biggest failure was Elvis Presley. I never could meet him. I tried everything. I knew he was at the top floor of the, what was then the Statler Hilton Hotel. And I went up the back way. I had a ways to get up. I got to the very top and I knocked on the door there. I thought, even if he just says hello, I could say that in the paper. I said hello to Elvis, you know, make it a headline. And a man stood there and I think he was about 7 feet tall. He looked that, and about 4 feet wide and dark eyes. And he looked at me and he said, "Go." And I went. But I tried. You know, a lot of people didn't even go that far. But I didn't know he was there.
Now, you have met a lot of the luminaries in the rock and roll world over the years. And a lot of them have gotten to know you. I understand that Lou Reed is a big fan of yours.
You know why? Because it's one of my philosophy things. My theory is when you hear someone's coming to town, you don't know much about it, but you have a lot of time. You have extra time and, you know, it's not completely filled up. I always go. If you don't like something, you can leave quickly. But my theory is always get there first. I had seen him in the Velvet Underground. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
The Velvet Underground. And that was at La Cave, which was down there about 107th. The Euclid or someplace, and I liked that group. Then when he went solo, he and his manager came to the old Hotel Hollanden and invited all the, you know, people that write about this, and I was the only one that showed up.
You were the only reporter at the press conference.
That showed up. You know what? I find out that they don't forget that. It's just like if you're new in school, say, and you transfer in something, no one talks to you, but someone comes up and says, "Hey, follow me. I'm going to tell you the quickest way to get the John or the quickest way to get the library." And you follow them. And even if you don't ever become a good friend, you always have a soft spot there. You know, they're the first one that noticed you as a person, you know? And I've done that a lot. I've been the first ones that always, in the beginning, I've tried to do that.
Well, this is not at all the image I have of journalists who go to meet rock stars. I mean, I guess I had always assumed that there was a lot of distance there and the rock stars would be mistrustful of reporters who want to come and talk to them.
Well, I don't know about that. I was just on my own having a good time. Of course, I loved it, so it probably showed in my eyes. And then I met Paul McCartney backstage when he was with Wings, and that was a wonderful interview. And the person from my other paper there had the opportunity and didn't go. So that shows you there was no interest in it. See, a lot of people my age didn't like it, but I was 40 when I started out practically. So anyway, that was a wonderful interview because I asked him that question. I said, "I hate to ask you, but are you going to ever get together again?" He said, "Nope." He said, the Belkins had offered him $4 million to do it again. And he said, "If we wanted to do it, really wanted to do it, we'd do it without any money." Then Linda was there. Remember Linda,
mm-hmm.
That lovely wife? And she was so cute, she's blonde, and she's sitting there with her kids, and she said, "You cannot reheat a souffle," she interrupted. You know, it was the only thing she said, but it was very, very interesting because later on she wrote cookbooks, you know, so she was thinking on her way, you know. So that was it. That was fun.
Now, I would guess that you must have been pretty unusual during all of these years. There probably were not too many women who were rock critics at that time. Were you kind of unique?
Yes, and Paul McCartney once said I was the only middle-aged woman he ever met, and so he always remembered me. It's not real flattering, but, you know, whatever works. He was so nice.
The way you talk about a lot of these people, you sound more like a fan than a rock critic. Do you see your role that way?
No, I see it. I am the eyes and ears of those who cannot get a ticket, who cannot afford a ticket, and who are too young or something. What I try to do is bring the humanness of the rock person to their eyes and ears, because that's what they want to hear. I do have a set list, and I can print that. And I do tell them what they did and what I think of it. But I also try to get a little bit of human interest into it. It's just if they want to hear that, you know, that. Well, I wasn't there at the time, but when Paul Simon forgot the words to a song, it was 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, you know that one?
Mm-hmm.
And he went to the audience and said, $5 to the first person that knows the next line. And that was a cute thing to put in a story. But I try to get little human things, and I think the kids love to read that. And I was writing for younger people then, too. And they want to know what I think of it. I know I felt very badly because my favorite at that time was still is Bruce Springsteen, and one concert wasn't quite as good as the other, and I had to say that.
Now, speaking of Bruce Springsteen, I've heard that he actually serenaded you in a concert once.
Well, that was because I was the first one to write about him. I went there in 74, and it was at the Agora, and it was so sparse that the owner, Hank Locati, went out in the lobby, and he got people that were in the pool room just to fill it up and make it look like people came to hear him, you know. But I thought he was pretty good. And then when he came in 75 at the Allen, I think by that time, Born to Run or something had come out, and I was just taken with him. He looked like a pirate up there. He had a little big hoop in one ear and a tam over one side. Of course, he looked like a dock hand. He had old jeans on. But he didn't sing about stuff like sweet songs and all the things. It was really tough stuff, like coming home from a concert and meeting his father as he tried to sneak upstairs. He had humanity in there, and he had a lot of real honest to goodness things that people were doing then. And I still consider him one of my favorites, practically. He's just so good. That's all there is to it.
Weren't you actually one of the first people to predict that he was going to become
a
superstar?
Yeah, that was at the Allen Theater, and I put in it, his name is Bruce Springsteen. He will be a superstar. And I turned it in, and they tried to take it out. And they said, Jane, we don't, you know, you put yourself in a spot like that. And we just don't do that. I said, please, I'll never do it again. Please. And I never have, of course. And they left it in. And so I showed it to him one time when he was at the Coliseum. We talked and laughed and everything. And he asked me my favorite song, you know, going on now. And it was Dancing in the Dark. Did you know that one?
Yes, I do.
It's a very serious song. It's not about like Fred Astaire or something like that. But I really got to me the music and everything. So that night, he dedicated it to me. I knew he did it on the spur of the moment because he had to do it without the orchestra because they hadn't with the band because they hadn't practiced it or anything. So, but yeah, I like him. I still do. His last show here was one of the best he's ever done.
Now you've met some of the real icons in the history of rock and roll, Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, yes, that was wonderful. Actually, there were two girls waiting to meet him when he got here. They were twins, and they were hanging on his arms. And I don't know who set it up. Anyway, it was every time I tried to talk to him a little bit backstage, one of the girls would sort of cuddle up closer. But I thought, well, my time will come. And we were backstage, and then that night beforehand, we went down. Have you heard of the Otto's Grotto?
No.
It was at the lower level of the Statler Hilton. It had a separate entrance. And he went down there before the show, and I saw him sitting there, and I sat in the table next to him, talked to him, and I noticed something very interesting about him. He signed any autograph you asked for with a little napkin with his right hand. You know, he's left-handed. He plays a left-handed guitar upside down, you know. And so that was strange. But the interesting thing was he couldn't stand it any longer, and he got up, and he grabbed a guitar, and he joined that group there. And I thought, you know, all their life, nothing will be as big for them as saying that Jimi Hendrix joined us, you know. Wasn't that wonderful? And then I followed him when he went down to the Shaker Heights to buy a Corvette the next day. He bought a blue Corvette. And he came in there with his dreadlocks, you know, and a dirty old black hat, sort of scruffy looking. And this was kind of a nice part of Shaker Heights. And they hadn't seen anyone like that before. And they were kind of hesitant, didn't know him. But I think he paid it with in cash, you know.
Many thousands of dollars, yeah.
Yeah, pulled $100 bills out of his pocket, you know. And he was he's so nice, so likable. I met his father later at the Lock Hall, and he told me that the reason he was right-handed writer was in his day, where he lived, they didn't give you any credit. If you were a kid and said you were left-handed, they said, the heck with you, get in there with that other bunch there. They were not respectful of you. Today they are, of course.
Now, you recently retired, but you've been going to rock concerts for years and years, for decades, and fashions have changed. I mean, here you were in your late 70s, going into your early 80s, and going to grunge concerts, a heavy metal group. I mean, did you feel out of place at all?
Well, no. Oh, I'll tell you what, though. After a while, people got to know me, and they'd say, oh, there she is. You know, they know that some older person there that looks like their mother is out there. See, I had a little trouble at first. One person would say to me, I used to bring young girls and daughters of friends of mine because they couldn't go. They didn't know what it was all about. And so I had this girl from maybe early high school. They said, oh, is that your daughter? And they said it not the way you talk, but in kind of a put-down way. And I said, oh, no, that's my granddaughter. I said, my daughter couldn't find her Golden Age bus pass. And so I exaggerate, and they're so taken back. And I said a few things I can't repeat over the air. But one time they said, who was it? Maybe it was Peter Gabriel or somebody out there, a girl who's sitting in the front row. She's a money person and, you know, probably all private stuff and thing. And she said, and do you really like Peter Gabriel? You know, as though, what are you doing here attitude. I said, oh, yes, we like each other. Of course, we used to be lovers, but now it's faded out now. But you know, that often happens. You'll find as you get older and start going with people, your love affairs, but you still become friends. And so she just stood there with her mouth open. But then she noticed they noticed I have a backstage pass on, and they have a lot of respect for a backstage pass.
Jane Scott talking with Steve Paulson about her 50-year career as rock critic for the Cleveland Plain Dealer.